Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Gerda is with us this hour, and we're going to have some fun. He is speaking next Tuesday, March 24, at 7 o'clock at Centennial Hall in the Central Public Library, and he's going to be talking about public enterprise, how the socialists save Milwaukee. Here we go. We're going to talk politics this hour, too. The program is free. It's open to the public, and John has done so much historical work on the socialists, and particularly on Frank Zeidler, who we lost a couple years ago. Wonderful, wonderful guy. And so we're going to talk about how socialism really formed this city, I think, in many ways, and for a good chunk of the 20th century. John has written a number of books, and we're going to talk to him about Frank Zeidler and other socialist mayors of the city of Milwaukee and what happened in terms of how they beautified the city, why they were called the sewer socialists, etc. John is also a local history columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's a lecturer. He speaks widely on Milwaukee history, and he has written books, 18 books now. Woo! 18 books, John. You're a busy guy. On subjects ranging from Frank Lloyd Wright, heavy industries, historic cemeteries. The Making of Milwaukee is his most current book, and it's a very lengthy book. It was also made into a Milwaukee Public Television documentary series in 2006 on the Making of Milwaukee. In case you haven't seen that, you should. It's very good. Hi, John.
Hi. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Just fine.
I still miss Frank Zeidler, don't you?
Oh,
you know, I think
I
about him so much. I really do.
No, I think he's in my thoughts every day.
Is
kind
he?
Of a role model. And as I get older, I think about how Frank aged. I'd like to do the same thing.
Right. And he made a study of it. As he made a study of it, I remember interviewing him when he was turning 80, and he had a book with him about what happens to the body when you turn 80. Only Frank would have something like that, right?
Only Frank at 90 would pick up an 800-page tome about China. And pronounce it fascinating.
Oh, how did he become mayor, John? Let's start with the Zeidler story.
He was mayor from 1948 to 1960, and a number of reasons, one of which was that his brother Carl had been mayor from 1940 until he went off to war in 42 and never came back. Frank had also made a name for himself as a member of the school board. He'd been involved in the Socialist Party since the 30s. And by the time Frank was running in 48, there was no longer a socialist electoral mechanism, as there had been in the days of Dan Hoehn or Amos Seidel, you know, back in 1910 and later. So Frank carried the socialist banner, but he no longer had that bundle brigade, which was this incredible. It was a machine in a way, but it was an extraordinarily efficient way to get any message in any language delivered to any house in the city within about 48 hours. So it really was. But before electronic communication, this really was remarkably efficient. So he did not have those tools at his disposal, but in a crowded field that included Henry Meyer and Henry Royce, you know, they were in that field
sure,
as well.
Sure.
Frank rose to the forefront, partly on the basis of name recognition and partly on the basis of just the man's obvious probity, his obvious
mm-hmm.
integrity. And
mm-hmm.
people, I think in that campaign, there were some who did a bit of red baiting, you know, said that it's a great story. Someone said that Frank would nationalize or socialize the corner grocery stores if he became mayor. And he went out and got the endorsement of the Independent Grocers Association. So Milwaukeeans, they had learned to trust the socialists. No, there was no fear factor there. And he stayed for 12 years and left after he decided, you know, he was not defeated in an election. He decided it was time to move on.
And then he was a socialist candidate for president at one point, wasn't he?
1976.
76.
Yep. Huh. And that was obviously more a statement of principle than an electoral hope.
Right. What does it mean, the phrase sewer socialism is associated with him particularly, or is it associated with the whole
the
socialist
whole movement,
reign?
The whole movement in Milwaukee. And where it comes from, Kathleen, is, you know, there had been from the mid-1800s on, there had been these rather complicated schools of thought and various schisms and, you know, people kind of splitting off over ideological fine points. What made the Milwaukee movement different from socialists elsewhere was their practicality. And that was largely the result of a man named Victor Berger, who came here actually as the tutor to a shoe manufacturer's son and ended up doing everything from drama criticism in the daily papers to publishing his own newspaper. Really interesting guy. Came from Austria. And he became kind of the, Frank called him an evolutionary moderate. He read Marx, but he developed a philosophy that you educate people to want the cooperative commonwealth by governing, and by governing well. So what split them off from socialists elsewhere was this intent to be elected and to govern when elected as efficiently as they possibly could. So there were, I think, the term he used was some Eastern smarties, you know, the more ideological, pure people on the East Coast. They called Milwaukee socialists sewer socialists because they were so involved in public works. And what you have to remember is back in those days, the river wasn't open sewer. No, the drinking water was a hazard to your health. You know, so these were not sort of neutral infrastructure projects. These were a means of saving lives, basically. So that's where the term came from. And rather than be offended, Milwaukee socialists embraced it. We get things done.
And embraced it in that that philosophy of governing, I'm sure, got them reelected because that affects people, your health, your daily kind of life, right?
And the term... No, the title of the lecture on Tuesday is Public Enterprise, and that's what they did. They ran the government as an enterprise. No, this was not a free lunch. No, it was not a soup line, although they did bend over backwards to help the unemployed. It was a means of using public capital for the public good for everyone. And what that meant in Milwaukee's case was all the public things, public housing, public libraries, public parks. Public schools, the lighted schoolhouse, vocational education, those are all things that are very much a part of the socialist fabric here in Milwaukee. They're still here, frayed, but they date in many ways to that period in our history.
What did they think about beauty? What was the importance of beauty, and what did they do with making this area more beautiful?
There's one of Frank Zeidler's first acts as mayor in 1948 was to bring hundreds of tulip bulbs he purchased himself and plant them around City Hall.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
So there was kind of an instinctive desire for beauty, and some of that goes back to sort of the German Gemütlichkeit, kind of the flowers in the front yard, tomato plants in the backyard, that sort of thing. And that's really an operative Milwaukee virtue to this day. But the guy who really carried that to an extraordinary level was Charles B. Whitnell. And he was Milwaukee's treasurer for a time in that sweep back in 1910, and then became, on his own time, on his own dime largely, he became the chief influence on land use planning in Milwaukee for probably 30 years. And on both the city, they had their own park system, and the county, as that park system developed. And Whitnell believed if you gave the people beauty, they would flock to nature, and everyone should be in contact with nature. So it was quite a romantic vision. It was a feeling that if you were somehow exposed to the beneficial influence of nature, you would be a better human being and a better citizen. So that's where the park system comes from. And Whitnell especially thought of that in terms of the waterways, all the creeks and all the rivers, the lakefront. And if you look at a map from 1923 of Charlie Whitnell's master plan for the parks and overlay it on today's map, pretty close.
Isn't it really pretty close? Yeah. And it's one of the most attractive things about the city, really, isn't it? The lakefront and the incredible series of parks.
Yeah, 15,000 acres.
How many?
15,000.
No.
Yep.
Isn't that something?
It's a multiple per capita of what Chicago has. You know, and their park system is, sometimes celebrated, the big ones and the boulevards. But Milwaukee really is. It's a world-class park system.
Yeah, it sure is. So was this phrase sewer socialism or socialism tossed around in the negative way that it's being tossed around now when they were in power here?
Yeah, in Milwaukee, this being the most German city in the country, and this having a huge working class population, and going back to the 1840s and 50s, you have these what they call the 48ers, these German intellectuals who were fleeing a failed revolt in the German states. You had kind of an inborn sympathy or receptiveness, you know, to the message of socialism. But that does not mean at all that people said, sure, you know, glad to vote for you. There was always a faction in the old line parties and in the church pulpits as well, sort of associating socialism with kind of, you know, godless materialism. A lot of these guys went to church, you know, so it was kind of a false charge. Frank was a pillar of Redeemer Lutheran, you know, until the day he died on the 19th in Wisconsin. So, yes, David Rose, who was a very interesting mayor in Milwaukee's history, as that socialist tide began to rise higher and higher year by year, he said that a socialist victory would be like putting the red flag over City Hall. So a lot of red baiting back in those years. In that way, things haven't changed.
Was Milwaukee unique in the country?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there were populist parties in many cities, especially where you had any kind of a working class population. There were, I suppose you'd call them quasi-socialist, but in terms of an active, organized, self-titled socialist party, in a city this size, Milwaukee was unique.
I had a listener who sent me an email yesterday already, knowing that you were going to be on and wanting to ask you these questions. You mentioned Rose, so let me use this email. Would the socialists have come to power if the Rose administration had not been corrupt, or was it, you know, the inborn receptivity, as you mentioned, that made them come to power?
I think the answer is both. If there had been good government, there would not have been a need for the socialists. If there had been good government, people would not have felt such revulsion about the established parties that they would have embraced an alternative, you know, that was not, in those days, as receptive as things were, not a mainstream alternative. You know, it was much more a working-class-oriented movement. So if Rose had not been the crook he was, there would not have been the opportunity. But the fact that there was an organized party with a well-thought-out platform and some really smart people running this thing, you know, that when the opportunity presented itself, they were ready.
Second question, did socialism as practiced in Milwaukee differ from that of other areas of the country and or the world?
A lot of the Milwaukee socialism was, to an important extent, much like the socialist parties, social democratic parties in Europe today. And Frank would call himself a social democrat. You know, this was not you know, nationalizing every industry and, you know, owning all the means of production. It was very important that people chose, you know, this philosophy, chose this alternative. So it has a kinship with the European parties. And in the United States, I think it's kind of in a class of its own because of the success it had in a city of this size. You know, there were some experiments in the East Coast, but in terms of actually being given control of a government, you know, Milwaukee really was unique.
So this whole thing about public libraries, museums, et cetera, public television, I know Frank was involved in as well. This was unique to a city?
It was throughout the country. There was corruption almost everywhere, and there were reform movements almost everywhere. So in some places it would be progressives. In some cases it would be middle-class good government types, you know, some club people, you know, who wanted to turn things around. So there was always that impulse, and it was always known that public libraries, going back to Ben Franklin, you got to have a place where people can get access to information. You know, that goes way back to the colonial days. So these things, it's not as if Sacramento didn't have libraries and Tallahassee didn't have parks. No, these are part of the fabric of civil society. In Milwaukee, they were a more central part of the government's platform and developed, I think, to a larger extent than they were elsewhere. Certainly true in the case of parks.
John Gerda is our guest. He's going to be giving the Frank Seidler Memorial Lecture next Tuesday, March 24, at the Centennial Hall Library in downtown Milwaukee. He's a wonderful Milwaukee historian and has was a very good friend of Frank Seidler's and has written extensively about not only that era of socialist leadership in the city of Milwaukee, but he's written about the whole history of Milwaukee and the making of Milwaukee. He's a local history columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has written 18 other books. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. Send it to John Treader. We'll just send it to this address, and John will get it to us. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. John's appearance at the library starts at 6:30, and it's free. Donations will be appreciated, of course, but it's free. All right, to your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. John Gerda is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Before we go to phone calls, when you talk about the honesty of these people, and I knew Frank pretty well, too, and he was just an exceptionally honest, good, trustworthy person. You compare that and look at the leadership of those years and compare it with what we're dealing with now with all these crooks, you know, we're giving money to, et cetera. It's a whole different world, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And part of that was the party itself attracted people. You know, Frank called himself the crusading type. You know, it attracted people who wanted to make things better.
Yeah.
And Victor Berger was, he said famously one time that for a Republican or a Democrat, honesty is the highest virtue to which you might attain. To a socialist, that's the beginning.
Oh, I love that quote.
So he was not above, you know, kind of sort of twisting the knife a little bit.
Let's go to phone calls. Gene from Oshkosh, our first caller. Hi, Gene.
And hi, John.
Hello.
The last time you were on, I had the pleasure of asking you a question, and now I'll just add something. You were just talking about Mayor Rose.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I grew up across from Kosciuszko Park, and or Kosciuszko, I suppose,
Kosciuszko,
in our nationality. And my father was responsible for having the statue moved from Beecher Street over to Lincoln Avenue.
Okay.
But my great uncle was secretary to Mayor Rose,
mm-hmm.
and within the family. Oh, this was an unbelievably great honor, and this made this man a very great man. You would also know the name Tony Stravinsky.
Sure.
And Drozdnikevich and so on. I'm that family.
Okay.
And watching your television program and reading your material, I realized that if you were secretary to Rose, you were probably up to your eyeballs in the cesspool of corruption.
You knew some secrets.
Yes. So I do want to thank you for changing my opinion. And by the way, I also worked for Lenny Fonz's campaign.
Okay. What one thing that is not often pointed out when you visit St. Joseph's Basilica, but if you go in there, face the altar, the first window on the right is donated, and it's there on the window by David Rose and his wife.
Oh, my.
So David Rose, who was as crooked a mayor as probably has existed in this country, he depended on the votes of the working class, Poles especially, but Germans as well. He's a Yankee himself from a little town in southwestern Wisconsin. But he would go down to Southside parishes and would do what he could to curry favor.
St. Joseph's was my home parish,
mm-hmm.
And I grew up there. Well, listen, thank you very much. I appreciate the ability to chat with you.
Oh, you should know, Gene, that you may know that the Kosciuszko statue is in some difficult shape, and a campaign has taken shape to restore
really?
It. No, so they're I think they're mounting a drive of $250,000, $300,000
really?
to keep him on his horse.
So. Well, as I said, the statue originally was on Beecher Street.
Right, 8th and Beecher. Yep.
Yeah, and so my dad was, I'm a Drozdnik.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And dad was president of Lincoln State Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And he was instrumental in having moved to Lincoln. So there is an organization to which I might contribute? Or?
Yes, there is. Go through Polanki, P-O-L-A-N-K-I. Susan Mikosh is on that committee, and she's been heading up the effort to save the statue.
Very, very good. I appreciate that information.
Okay.
And pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Isn't that something? That guy happened to call and the statue needs help and he's going to give it. That's all right. Michael from Milwaukee, hello.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Fine, Michael. How are you?
Good. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. I was hoping for a long, long time that I could get to talk to Mr. Gerda because I admire his TV shows and I read his books. And I am aspiring myself to, well, I've done quite a bit of research on the early trails of Milwaukee. And I was hoping to talk to him at some point about getting some help with it because I come up with so much data that it's just so, some of it's kind of conflicting and confusing. And but anyway, so, but my question is, what party did Solomon Juno, Kilbourne, and Walker belong to? And obviously not the same party, but...
Boy, back in those days, things were a bit more fluid. You didn't have Republicans until the 1860s, obviously, you know, or the 1850s, you know, Lincoln being elected in 1860. And I think Juno was probably agnostic politically, but may well have sort of leaned Democratic, as most people did in those years. And back in the mid-1800s, the Democrats were the party of the working class and the immigrants. And that's a lot of what Milwaukee was. I mean, two-thirds of our population was foreign-born as early as 1850, or 1860, rather. So we had this large population that was very receptive to the Democratic message. And they pretty much ran the town for some time. Republicans, you know, begin to kind of pull up a bit later in the 1800s. But my guess is that both Walker and Kilbourne would have voted in the Democratic column. And Juno as well, although you don't get a sense that this man was highly political. A lot of that was done by Morgan Martin, who was his business partner. And he was a very adept politician whose first cousin happened to be James Duane Doty, who was territorial governor, which didn't hurt.
Hey. Does that answer your questions here, Michael?
Oh, yes. Yeah, thank
good,
you.
Good luck with your project. All that research, you know, it can be overwhelming, but at some point you kind of sit down and say, well, where's the main line here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. When you talked about these people gathering to make things better, do you think that's unique to the sewer socialism of Milwaukee? Or?
Oh, no. I think we're... Milwaukee is not, you know, this Brigadoon, you know, that's sort of somewhere in an ether. You know, it doesn't exist for other communities. I think there's a natural human impulse to react to abuse and to try to correct things to improve life for all. I think in Milwaukee that was realized to a greater extent and was felt more deeply, I think, than it was elsewhere. There's a very strong sense, and I think we've lost it at our peril, of this sense of mutuality.
Mm-hmm.
We're all in this together. And you really see that in the last generation or so with our attitude toward government. I think a lot of people in both this country, perhaps since Watergate, and in Milwaukee since the county pension scandal, especially, that being kind of a watershed, tend to look at those who govern as kind of a predatory them instead of us. And the real genius, the real accomplishment of the socialists in Milwaukee was to enforce and really promote a sense that government is us and government is all of us. And that, I think, has a great deal of power. And I think we've lost that to a large degree. But my own feeling, maybe it's more a hope than a belief, is that that's still there as kind of a latent quality about Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
Still sets us apart from other places in the country.
I think so. I think that's why a lot of us have stayed here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael, for the call. Mike is next from Milwaukee, South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm standing in my backyard over in Grant Park. And I'd like Mr. Gerda to comment and elaborate on the personality of Charles Witt, how was he able to push through this agenda of these parks? I believe Grand Park was the first major park. I'd like him to talk more about Whitnall and the personality of Whitnall.
Boy, someone should do a biography of Whitnall because he was just a fascinating guy. He was, among other things, a landscape gardener, almost a landscape architect.
Oh, really?
He was also, he ran something called the Commonwealth Savings Bank, so he was a banker, but a socialist banker, which is like jumbo shrimp, kind of an oxymoron. And just a very intellectual guy who had a strong sense of what life should be in contact with nature. But what really set him apart was his determination to make this thing happen. You know, it wasn't enough just to write letters to the editor, you know, not to have these study clubs, you know, that would meet and kind of kick the ideas around. He was tireless in browbeating public officials and developing not just ideas but pressure. He was a good lobbyist and someone, he would be more cerebral than a lot of people you would think of as being active in politics today, but someone who was determined that his message get across. And once it got across, he was the guy on the ground. He was the one who put the stakes in where these parks would be. So a lot of his work sort of took advantage of that same instinct for bettering life at a time when the environment here was just being trashed. You know, and this is part of the American ethic back in those years. There was a bit before Whitnall's time. Milwaukee was way behind the curve. You know, we had We had in terms of proportion to our population, we had one of the smallest systems in the country. It was just these little parks like Red Arrow or Clark Square or Zeidler Union Square. You know, down here near the train station today. And in the 1880s is when you have the first public-spirited citizens who were largely apolitical. A guy named Christian Wall, who was actually a retired glue manufacturer, he's one of the conveners of Milwaukee's Park Commission. And in 1891 is when they purchased the first big parks that we know today. Lake, Riverside, Washington, Kosciuszko, Humboldt. These are still with us. And those are part of the pre-socialist park system. So we had kind of a start. So Grant was not the first park. But then you had the socialists and Charlie Whitnall's master plan in 1923. Then it was just off to the races.
And was there a lot of, because you could think, well, businesses want this land or very wealthy people may want some of the lake land. Was there a lot of opposition to making this public land?
That's really interesting because sometimes there was, sometimes there wasn't. Lincoln Memorial Drive, which is one of the most spectacular stretches of lakefront in the entire Midwest. You know, I can think of no place besides perhaps Toronto that's done a better job preserving lakefront land. And that area was the backyards of people with names like A.L. Smith's son Lloyd and Pabst's and the Walls. They were a little bit inland. But this was Lake Drive, Terrace Avenue, Wall Avenue. These are really, you know, some of the wealthiest families in Milwaukee. So you might think that they would resist.
Right.
Kind of the hoi polloi, you know, kind of drinking beer and partying, you know, down there on their lakefront. For a time, there was resistance, and what really overcame that resistance was the fact that you had these northeast storms that were washing away their backyards.
Ah.
So Lincoln Memorial Drive was both flood control or erosion control and public parkland.
Ah.
So they were quite happy.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
So it's kind of a mixture of self-interest and public interest. But in other cases, and this is relatively recent, in the 1960s, what's now Back Bay Park, they call it Baby Park, up there near St. Mary's Hospital, that was covered with some pretty nice homes of the same scale you see around there in the North Point neighborhood. The county actually purchased those and knocked them down, you know, just before the preservation movement got going. So Drive preservation is nuts today. The point, though, was to preserve the best of the public views for the public. So that was an operative virtue into the very recent past.
Let's go back to phone calls. Let's go next to Roger from Fitchburg. Hello, Roger.
Hi. I'd like to let people know that there will be the Socialist Party of Wisconsin Executive Committee meeting on April 11th. the monthly meeting in Madison at the Wilmar Center at 4:30 in the afternoon. Interested persons can attend. We're going to try to get going again with more emphasis the Madison chapter. So that will be at 4:30 at 5:30 or 6, the monthly socialist potluck starts. And after people put down some fine dining, we have a speaker.
Okay.
So there'll be a lot going on later in that day. That's at 4:30.
What are the socialists doing in Madison these days, Roger?
Well, we're getting educated that there is such a variety, so many dozens of causes that
no shortage
that we're involved in. We're just trying to get a bit more organized. We're putting an awful lot of energy into, of course, single payer health care for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Wisconsin Health Security Act is getting our support, though that's not a socialist venture at all. Socialists participate. Put a lot of energy into it, and anti-war stuff, of course, and feeding the homeless, doing work for the for homeless people and lower income people with lower income. Too many other groups than I can mention here. The Veterans for Peace has a large representation of socialists in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, having potlucks continues an old tradition in Milwaukee, at least. The Socialist Party picnic, still an annual event, you know, was sometimes they would have hundreds, perhaps thousands of people there, and there were some Social Democrats was the party's name. Some of their chapters, some of their units would begin and end the meetings with singing. And a lot of this is the old German choral tradition, and beer was probably served.
Thanks very much for the call. So what happened? Why do we not have socialist rule here in Milwaukee now?
Because we have Democrats.
Ah.
What happened, really simply, is that during the Depression, you have Roosevelt being elected in 1932, and the Democrats pretty much co-opted, first of all, the base, which was the labor unions.
Yeah.
That was hugely important. The movement here in Milwaukee. And Victor Berger called it the Milwaukee idea, which was kind of this hand-in-glove relationship between the party and the workers. They were one and the same. One was the economic side, one was the political side. And once the working class, the unions, had gone to the Democratic column, that pretty much removed kind of the wheels, in a sense, of the party as an electoral organism. And I think Dan Hoehn himself, he was voted out of office in 1940. He became a Democrat.
Oh.
So you have that kind of defection going on. So in a lot of ways, there was something of a handoff from socialists to Democrats here in the Milwaukee area. At the same time, some animosity, because they were still both fielding candidates back in those years. But in terms of philosophy, in terms of base, in terms of kind of a worldview, there's certainly some commonalities.
Yeah. Let's go next to Ruth from Shawano. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
Hi.
I welcome this opportunity because the name Frank Zeitler definitely has remained in my memory. I attended the high school, West Division High School, and graduated from there, and that was his high school.
It sure was.
And he was definitely an alumnus that everyone paid attention to.
And he and Pat O'Brien and Douglas MacArthur. There's actually an active West Division Alumni Association.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Frank was ahead of that for a number of years.
Yes, he was.
He would organize the reunions.
Yeah, he had me talk out there about 3 or 4 years ago, and it was just I went out to this restaurant on the west side around Mayfair, and there were probably 150, 200 people there.
Oh, my gosh, John.
So there's still a school spirit.
The Germans definitely were the powerful voice in Milwaukee. My mother came over here from Austria in 1920, and of course the Germans were pretty much in charge of everything. And the Zeitler definitely was a German
Absolutely. They
and were, who was Carl Zeitler?
Carl was Frank's older brother.
Yeah. So wasn't he a mayor for a while?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a mayor.
Yes,
sure.
From 1940 yeah. until 1942.
Hmm. And I remember when Frank came to visit the school, there was a celebration. We were proud. And then ominous, and he was proud, and school was proud of him, too.
Mm. Oh, sure, sure. And the Germans did run things. It took them a while. The Yankees and the Irish had the upper hand in Milwaukee until probably the 1880s, even though the Germans were a majority of Milwaukee's population as early as 1860. And what's a really interesting kind of a, again, you know, what a great country, America, all this diversity. Frank Zeiler and Carl were raised in Merrill Park, which was a very heavily Irish neighborhood. And Frank said when he was growing up, at places like West Division, you know, the Irish girls were, you know, kind of a world apart. And some of the girls who lived in the big houses up on Highland, you know, he said, you didn't know how to date them, I think was what the term he used. No, even though there was a lot of physical proximity, there was a lot of social distance, you know, in that neighborhood. So in a neighborhood that was always represented by an Irish politician, you have a German family that gives Milwaukee two mayors.
Isn't that something? That's a great story. So tell me about the gathering of this alumni group from West Division High School. Who are all these people? What did you talk about with them? That must have been a great time.
I talked about the West Side's history. You know, Frank asked me to talk about the neighborhood. And he was revered. You know, he was there. People would bring scrapbooks, old photographs. Someone brought a map of what the businesses along North 27th Street had been. You know, so it was people of a certain age, obviously, you know, probably 70s. You know, some older would be the average. But just a great deal of fondness, for the institution and each other, and also, you know, I try to make the point that. You know, change is the only constant, and kind of the diversity of ethnic groups you had there in their years is still very much a fact of life. Now it's Milwaukee High School of the Arts, and it draws people from throughout the city and metropolitan area as well. And in some ways, it's kind of a reprise of what was going on when a lot of them were in school.
Mm-hmm. I can just imagine that gathering. Mm, that's great. Thanks, Ruth, very much for your call. Let's go next to Virginia from Oshkosh. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning. I'm calling on a serendipity kind of thing. Early this morning on a Green Bay TV channel, they were talking about a big ghost ship festival and mentioned the wreck of the Lady Elgin, which carried apparently 400 or more top Irish political leaders of Milwaukee, and had it not been for the sinking and the death of those politicians, the TV spokesperson said that maybe Milwaukee may have taken a different direction than it did after the fact. Could you comment on that?
Sure. It's a famous story, and one that is really wrapped up in a distinguished chapter in Wisconsin's political history. The Fugitive Slave Act is passed in 1850, which gave slave owners their right to come north to pursue their runaway slaves. Wisconsin was a hotbed of abolitionist sentiment. Mm. Governor Alexander Camp Randall, in Madison, they called him a fire-breathing abolitionist, and he was determined that Wisconsin would not enforce that law. So somebody came from the South, said, "We're sorry, go back to your home." And there was a rescue of Joshua Glover back in 1854, which really, you know, put Milwaukee and Wisconsin on the map among abolitionists. A runaway slave was jailed in Milwaukee, and a crowd of abolitionists and their sympathizers broke him loose. And he ended up spending the rest of his life in Canada. There's a book, I believe, called Journey to Freedom. Mm-hmm. It came out about a year and a half ago. It tells the Glover story. So that was a highlight in Wisconsin civil rights history. But then where the Irish get involved with Lady Elgin is Randall asked all the militia units in the state to back him against the federal government. And the Union Guards, who were headed by a man named Garrett Berry, who was a Democratic politician and recall that Randall's a Republican, said, "No, we are sworn to enforce the laws of the United States." Randall disbanded them. and disarmed them. So they were no longer a militia unit, and they did not go quietly. They went down to Chicago on the Lady Elgin on an excursion to see Stephen Douglas, who was their candidate in 1860 against Lincoln in the presidential race. And the purpose was to raise money to rearm themselves. So this was kind of an act saying, you know, we refuse to, you know, kind of disband on the authority of someone whose authority we do not recognize. We recognize the higher federal authority. Then coming back to Milwaukee, they were rammed by a lumber schooner off Winnetka, Illinois, and approximately 300 people died. It was the second worst. The Eastland in Chicago was the worst in terms of loss of life. But the second worst series of fatalities in Great Lakes maritime history. So certainly a tragedy of major scale. And it was not just the Irish who went down. There was a member of parliament from the UK who went down. There was a German fire company. A lot of them lost their lives. But it was a large concentration of Irish families as well. And it is often said that Milwaukee may have been more a Chicago-type city run by the Irish, you know, had that not happened. My own feeling, my own belief, is that Milwaukee by that time was so German. You know, we were majority by 1860 that the German establishment would, in any case, you know, have been in time the dominant, politically as well as socially. But it's a fascinating chapter, and there are readings. There's one coming up here, I think, at the Irish Cultural and Heritage Center. Talk about a statue in the river itself, or a sculpture in the statue itself to kind of commemorate the Lady Elgin. So that is becoming, it has not receded into the memory vaults. It's something that's still very much a part of our historical fabric.
Hearing you speak, this is why we study history, right? I can see why you do what you do. It's just, yeah.
And even though the Irish seem to have the upper hand up until that time.
They were certainly influential. The Yankees were probably more influential.
Okay.
You know, and Yankees back in those years was anybody born east of Chicago, of English background, largely New York and New England. And they were the ones who got here on the ground floor. The Irish, because they spoke English and were well organized as a group, would tend to rise politically early on. A man named Gilbert White was Milwaukee's village president before it was a city. So very early they were involved in politics, but it would be an exaggeration to say that they ran the town. You know, they were part of the establishment, but it was the Yankees who were more powerful back in those early years.
Thanks, Virginia, so much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. John Gerda is our guest, and John's going to be speaking at the Centennial Library, Central Public Library, downtown Milwaukee, and that's coming up next Tuesday, March 24. It's the Frank Seidler Memorial Lecture, the topic will be Public Enterprise, How the Socialists Saved Milwaukee. Here's our number. A few more minutes left in the show. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Gerda is our guest. Here's an email for you, John. The Socialist Party today, we've already talked about what brought about the end of their reign. What's the difference between a present-day socialist and one from the era that you're speaking of?
Well, I think the big difference would be involvement in practical electoral politics. As the socialists have been marginalized electorally, it's become, you know, a stand of consciousness, involvement, awareness, I think plays a very important role, but no longer actively involved in the process of government, you know, which is what the socialists were doing, especially in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s.
Mm-hmm. Carl from Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy.
Howdy.
I was wondering if you knew if there what the relationship between the socialists and the black community was.
When they were very dominant here in Milwaukee, and the dates are 1910 to 1960. 1910 is the first socialist mayor, and the heyday was probably 1910 until 1940, when Dan Hoehn was defeated in the election by Carl Zeidler. So during that 30-year period, which was kind of the heyday, there was a relatively small black population in Milwaukee. Dan Hoehn himself, though, was, like all socialists, determined that there be equal rights for all groups, equal opportunities to the extent they could possibly be enforced. And there was a couple named Wilbur and Artie Halyard who came here from Beloit back in the early 1920s and were trying to found a financial institution that became Columbia Savings and Loan, still here. And Halyard Park is named for them. And Dan Hone was instrumental in helping that institution get started. So there were, early on, some good examples of cooperation, collaboration, and help, you know, going back to the home period. And in Frank Zeidler's case, even though he did not have the socialist organization behind him to anywhere close to the extent that his predecessors did, he was famously passionate about the need for equal rights and equal responsibilities. No, he breathed that whole spirit of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Bernadette from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question that is a little broader than just the Zeidler period. I'm from Chicago, and often my brother, who is a proud Chicagoan, will show me a book that is called Chicago Then and Now. And I'm wondering if John Gerter is aware of any book, this is like a coffee table type book, that would show scenes and scenes actually mostly of times in the past.
Actually, Bernadette, he wrote one. He wrote one.
You did the making in Milwaukee.
Right.
Yeah, I'm looking at a larger, you have a larger book?
I don't, but there is, in fact, a book called Milwaukee Then and Now.
Oh, it is. There is. Oh, great.
By a woman named Sandy Ackerman, A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N, and it was published probably, 4 or 5 years ago. And it's, they call it re-photography. What you do is you find an old picture, and then you take the present view from the same perspective.
Oh,
and
that's great.
In some cases, it's the same building. In some cases, you're looking at a parking lot. In some cases, you're looking at a high-rise condo. So, yes, Then and Now, Sandy Ackerman's book, I think probably is part of that same family that you're talking about in Chicago.
Oh, great.
There are also some wonderful architectural treatises. Russ Zimmerman has a book called Magnificent Milwaukee that's coffee table and treats more of the higher-end houses in Milwaukee. A guy named, I think, Jonathan Corum has a book about Milwaukee architecture. There's a wonderful book called Built in Milwaukee that was published back in the 1970s. And the subtitle is An Architectural View of the City Before 1930. And it's got some wonderful photographs, wonderful history.
Book.
Really,
yes.
Really good piece of work. Piece of work.
Oh, good. One last comment about the Irish and the control. My mother, growing up in Chicago, often told the story of how the priests would tell the Germans in church, "You Germans send your children to work. The Irish are going to run this city."
you might have reversed those roles here in Milwaukee.
And his honor did, and then some, right? Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the call. Bye. Let's go to Bonnie from Fond du Lac. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I find your guests very, very interesting. My question is this. I recently read a book by Mary Rousseau was the author, and it's called Letters to and from Dutch Immigrants in Wisconsin. And many of the letters refer to Dutch Hill in Milwaukee. I was wondering if you could give me the present-day location of Dutch Hill, if you would know where that would be.
If I had to guess, it would be around a settlement that used to be called Williamsburg, which was roughly 3rd Street and Keefe. Part of the north side today. And there was actually a picture of it in the Making of Milwaukee book. The Grudemont family, who are still well-known in real estate, they actually had a windmill up on that hill.
Oh, really?
And it stood on 3rd, right around, in Milwaukee, it's now called Rose Park, called Garfield Park. That was very heavily German, but there were some Dutch families there as well.
Huh. Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for the call. We have time for one more phone call. Virginia from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm very interested in Jones Island. An uncle of mine used to talk about Jones Island. My grandfather was a tugboat captain, and it was the Kashubi people.
The Kashub.
Who were Polish?
Yeah, Kashub, right. Kashub. It's a fascinating. Do you have a question about Jones Island? It's a fascinating period in our history.
I don't really have a question. I'm just interested in them.
Okay.
Where did they come from? And
we have about 30 seconds.
Okay, the story very simply is that they were fishermen from the Baltic Sea coast of Poland. And they settled on Jones Island from the 1870s until roughly 1915, 1920. There were roughly 1,600 people there in the closest thing Milwaukee's ever had to a genuine urban village. Just a fascinating period in our history. May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, Wild Space Dance Company is doing a series of performances called Map of Memories. That are It's a suite of dances based on life on the island. And they had to do it because they did it last spring, and they had so much demand that it's a repeat performance. And I'm talking about Jones Island before each of those performances in the evening.
Oh, wonderful. All right. You'll have to go to that, Virginia. Thanks for the call. John, thank you. Always a pleasure. This is a great hour. Thank you.
Enjoyed it, Kathleen.
Thanks. John is going to be speaking at Centennial Hall, Central Public Library, downtown Milwaukee. It is the Frank P. Zeidler Memorial Lecture. That's next Tuesday. Doors open at 6:30. He's speaking at about 7 o'clock, and it'll be well worth your time. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios, and thanks for all of your really interesting calls. Be with you again on Monday for All Things Political at 9 o'clock. So until then, this is the Ideas Network.